Real House with Deej and Trav, where legitimate film criticism goes to die. It's been so long, but we're back. I'm joined, as always, by my idiot brother, DJ Wheeler. How are you, DJ?
What's happening, everybody? I'm Donald Faison. Welcome to Who Gets the Last Laugh. Did I do that wrong?
No, I think you did, DJ. I think you say something different. Something about brothers and captains and kings. But either way, we'll truck along. We apologize for the long delay in the show. Both DJ and I were quite busy, but I think we're going to get back into the swing of things and be able to do weekly episodes again, which will be super nice for all of us. Now how the show works is we start with a section we call the Minority Report, where we talk about whatever media we've been consuming recently, and after that we switch to the Mr. Holland's Opuses segment, where we talk about the music we've been listening to recently. And by the way, the intro, outro, and break music for this episode is going to come from those records, specifically New Moon by The Men and Pelagial by The Ocean. And after all that, we get into our full review of Iron Man 3. But without further ado, DJ, I ask you, where's your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
I do have one, and I actually need everybody listening to rush out right now and watch my Minority Report for the week, because it's without doubt the best new TV show of 2013, and if its ratings don't improve, it's not going to be around much longer. The show is called Hannibal, and it's the newest and quite frankly best adaptation of Thomas Harris's Hannibal Lecter novels, including Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. The idea is that this TV show presents the early years of investigator Will Graham's relationship with psychologist Hannibal Lecter before the good doctor is outed as a cannibalistic serial killer. The two of them are recruited by good old Larry Fishburne to form a task force capable of tracking and arresting the country's most disturbed and dangerous serial killers. Hannibal's selected for the team because of his wealth of psychiatric insight, and Will Graham's recruited because he's been cursed with kind of this unique cocktail of Asperger's and autism that gives him what the show calls perfect empathy, or the ability to like completely understand someone's emotions and motivations. So it makes him like the perfect FBI profiler. The way in which the show presents Will's abilities, if you can call them that, is nothing short of brilliant. And everybody should go right now and watch the first 5 minutes of the pilot episode to get an idea of what I'm talking about. Unfortunately, by the time this episode of The Real House airs, I think the Hannibal pilot will have expired on Hulu, unless you have a Plus account, which who has one of those? The basic idea is that Will enters a crime scene, and what I can only describe as like a blade of light swings across the screen and removes everything except the details that are of great importance to Will's investigation. And then eventually Will takes on the role of the killer himself and recreates the scene in chilling detail. It's absolutely stunning. Now, the nature of this show is that it spends a lot of time talking about the psychological motivations of its characters, which is usually something I consider a cop-out because it's an easy way of explicitly stating why characters are doing certain things without having to write scenes that clarify those motivations in nonverbal form. But the way that Will and Hannibal duel and outthink one another all while attempting to work together makes for such great television that I'm willing to forgive some of the on-the-nose writing. I haven't at this point even said anything about Mads Mikkelsen's performance. I don't care if you're an Anthony Hopkins fan. Mads Mikkelsen is turning in some dynamite work here, and it's without doubt the best rendition of the character we're ever likely to see. His chiseled face just kind of dominates every single scene that he's featured in, and in many cases, he doesn't even say anything, so when he does speak, it's all the more haunting and effective. And if that weren't enough, this is one of the most beautifully photographed shows on TV. Like, I'll pause the show to get up and get a glass of water or something, and I'll just be mesmerized by whatever random freeze frame I happen to stop on. The actors and objects are placed in such precise locations in every scene to highlight the sense of space, and the shots themselves are so immaculately composed that it's hard to look away even in the most gruesome moments. So yeah, this one is a full-on rave for me. Get out there and watch it, because without increased viewership, it's not going to come back for a second season. It might not even make it through its first season. Trev, have you caught any of these episodes of Hannibal yet?
I haven't, but I'm about to start watching it pretty soon. I guess my question for you, D, just out of curiosity, is it the kind of show that's going to be more focused on sort of like the mystery of the week type of plot line? Is it episodic, or are there a lot of through lines? Like, is it like an overarching story that we're following?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So back in the 90s, right, when the X-Files came out, they kind of introduced this idea of the monster of the week, you know, wherein there was a running serialized story in the X-Files that would continue from episode to episode, but some of the weekly outings were just kind of one-and-done episodes about an alien or a monster or something. And so Hannibal at this point is really wrestling with which of those two it should be. The first season is dedicated to this running story of a killer called the Minnesota Shrike Killer, and what it's trying to do is also establish a Monster of the Week format that ties in individual other serial killers to the overall mystery, and it always ends up feeling really forced. I'd kind of prefer it if they decided just to go one way or the other, stick with one story or don't bother trying to make connections between them, because when they do, it does feel a little forced, and that's probably the weakest part of the show at this point, is those forced connections between episodes.
But it does sound like it's a pretty hearty recommendation from you, right, Deej? Would you remind everyone what station they would find this on if they were trying to look for it?
Oh yeah, good call. I don't think I mentioned that. So Hannibal is currently airing on NBC Thursday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern, I think it is. And then you can also watch the recent episodes for free on Hulu. And if you've got a Hulu Plus account, I think you can watch everything back to the pilot episode. So that wraps it up for my segment. Trav, can I ask you, where is your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
It turns out I do have one this week. I saw Pain and Gain the other day, which is the new film from Michael Bay. So the worst part is that I kind of like this movie. It's a train wreck, to be sure, but it's actually quite an enjoyable one. So the premise of the movie is that these three bodybuilders decide that, you know, we do all this work and we're like the most physically fit people on the planet, and yet we're like, in terms of our financial success, we're like scrounging for a living. So, you know, we've worked this hard to improve ourselves, so we should get some reward for it. We should, you know, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps by stealing from other people. And so it's basically a crime drama about bodybuilders. The weird thing about it is that it's like Michael Bay tried to make Fargo and Reservoir Dogs at the same time and have it be about bodybuilders. And I really respect the ambition, even though it's a complete failure. There's this weird mixture of really stylized editing. Like, there's freeze frames, there's slow motion, there are titles that fly across the screen, with some like legitimately dark comedy that, despite not being that good, was at least an admirable attempt. The biggest example of this is that of sort of this being an attempt at being interesting, is that the movie tries to be edgy by giving almost every character, even some secondary characters, a voiceover narration of their own. And it's a cool idea. I like that sort of, you know, you take something that's breaking the rules and you just break it a lot. But it's a complete wash, because they're never saying anything that you're not just seeing on screen. There's a point where Dwayne Johnson's character is talking about Mark Wahlberg's character, as Mark Wahlberg is explaining like the heist that they're about to do with like all these charts and things. But you don't hear him explaining the heist. You hear Dwayne Johnson saying, "Mark Wahlberg was a real genius about this sort of thing." Like, he could have just shown us Mark Wahlberg being a real genius about this sort of thing. But I guess it's cool that they have all these characters have their own voiceover narration. So the main characters of the film, like I said before, it's Mark Wahlberg, Dwayne Johnson, and also Anthony Mackie, who listeners might remember from The Hurt Locker. They're all, like, ridiculously one-dimensional, and that's one of the big problems with the movie. Even though it's based on a true story, but it obviously changes how these people are, because there's no way human beings are that one-dimensional. The most heinous of the three is Dwayne Johnson's character, who's, like, entire... you could summarize his entire character as just super devout, born-again Christian who still beats people up. Like, that's all he is. The three actors perform their characters well enough, but they're not really given that much to do. When the lines are funny, they deliver them well, but sometimes the script is just not that great. But like I said, I do kind of like this movie, and I'd rather have something like this that's at least trying to do something risky, and even if it fails at it, than have a movie that plays it completely safe and quote-unquote succeeds at those, like, tiny goals. And Pain and Gain is definitely in that former category. DJ, did you ever end up seeing Pain and Gain?
No, I never saw it, but I was kind of curious to see it kind of for the same reasons that you mentioned. I mean, I'm not really that much of an opponent of Michael Bay. I mean, his movies are fun, and a lot of people riff on him, but the guy wants to he has his own vision, and he's consistent, so it's like sometimes I appreciate what he does, so I was kind of intrigued to see this one. My question for you, Travis, I've heard that comparison to, like, Fargo and some of those other movies quite frequently, so does this movie follow the format where it claims to be a true story and clearly isn't? Because I thought I heard this is actually based on actual events.
It is actually based on actual events, and that's where some of then that's I think the reason that I end up liking this movie is that it doesn't there's a brief mention of it at the beginning of the movie, and then you sort of forget that that it's based on a true story, and then periodically the movie will just remind you of that. I won't give away how, because it's really funny when it happens. But it's just like this slap in the face, like, oh, wow, this ridiculous thing that I'm seeing occur on screen actually also happened in real life. And so it's able to milk a lot of humor out of the fact that these really terrible things actually happened. And so that's kind of cool. But yeah, the from what I've read, do I call it plot if it's real life? some of the events were changed a little bit so that you have more sympathy for the who are criminals ostensibly, because they're the main characters. But other than that, the main bullet points of what occurs is supposedly consistent with real life. But I think that'll be it for Pain and Gain. After the break, we're going to switch into our Mr. Holland's Opus segment, where we talk about the music we've been listening to recently. Here's a clip from one of those records.
Welcome back to The Real House, the elephant graveyard of film criticism. I am DJ Wheeler, and I am joined, as always, by my brother, my captain, my king, Travis Wheeler. And the two of us are about to move into our Mr. Holland's Opuses segment of the show, where we discuss some of the records we've been listening to lately in hopes that we can recommend them to you guys, our listeners. So, Trav, can I ask you once again, what new opus has Mr. Holland composed for you this week?
Yeah, I picked up the new record by The Men titled New Moon. Now, I have only heard The Men's, besides this one, New Moon, I've only heard The Men's previous record, Open Your Heart, which is like sort of like punchy, almost punk sound to it that's pretty abrasive. But Deej, I know you've heard their earlier stuff, or at least I think you have, and from what I gather, it's sort of like a noise rock, almost like shoegazy thing. Am I right in saying that?
It's definitely noise rock. It's kind of like a nocturnal kind of noise rock. It's a little bit ambient, but not necessarily in the shoegaze territory, because it's like so abrasive that you'd be jarred out of gazing at your shoes for too long.
but I guess the point of my asking you this is because I know that that Open Your Heart was considered sort of quite a reinvention of their sound into something quite different, and this album, New Moon, is sort of continuing on that trend of the men reinventing themselves. It's got a lot, it's a much more rustic sound here, with influences from like country music and like Tom Petty sometimes. It sounds a lot like, you know, you're sort of Americana a lot of the time. There's like lap guitars and things. I'm not sure if it's actually like steel guitars, but at least sounds like it. But ultimately, I don't really find myself enjoying this record, because it just feels like all this reinvention just feels like an affectation for the point of changing the sound, because that's what they're expected to do. Like, I don't even feel like they want to be making music that sounds like this. Especially in the early tracks, the ones that come to mind are the opening track, Open the Door, and also a track called The Seeds. They're really slow, and there's like no life to them. You don't feel like the people making the music are having fun, so why should you be having fun? It just doesn't have the energy that propelled that previous record. And the times that the album does succeed are when the album breaks into like bluesier, heavier songs, like the second track, Half Angel, Half Light, and certain sections of the closer, Supermoon. But those just leave you wanting a whole record that sounds like that, and the whole record doesn't sound like that. The second half of the album is a lot stronger than the first. It picks up the pace a little bit with some more high-energy tracks, but at that point it feels like a little too late, because I'm not engaged enough in the album anymore to even notice what's going on that's good, and the songs aren't fantastic enough to sort of stand on their own that I would want to just put on the second half of the album or put on those songs individually, especially since the men aren't really don't really seem to be concerned with creating like a couple songs here and there that are like really strong. It's more of just you pop on the record and just get into the mood that they want you to be in, so it's not really a record that's even built for that. I think a good sort of microcosm for the album is the song I Saw Her Face. It's the fifth track on the album. It's, for the majority of it, it's like this really boring trotting ballad that doesn't ever really pique your interest until the last 40 seconds, where the song's during the guitar solo, the song suddenly switches to double time. Solo gets like so much more interesting, but at that point, you know, there's like no time left, so I'm not really even that invested in it, even though it starts being cool. Like I said, the back half of the album isn't really worth the slog of the beginning, so ultimately I say give this album, New Moon by the Men, a pass. I'd recommend picking up their previous record, Open Your Heart, which I think is also not perfect, but much better than this one if you're looking for an entry point to the men. DJ, have you heard this one, New Moon?
I've not heard New Moon, because a lot of the reviews I read kind of mentioned the same thing you did, that it was kind of moving towards some more mellow territory, and I was not pleased to hear that, so I haven't really gotten around to listening to this one yet. But so one thing I've noticed in following the men's discography over their past two records is that it almost seems like they embed tracks within their albums that serve as clues to what their next shift in style might be. Like, for example, on Open Your Heart, there was a track called Country Song, and then another track called Oscillation, I think it was. And both of those songs were really mellow, really slow, like extended instrumentals, low tempo. So I guess my question, Trav, is does New Moon have any tracks on it that maybe suggest where the men might be heading in the future?
I mean, it's hard to tell before, you know, before I see what...
Come on, Trav, shoot an arrow and paint a target around it.
yeah, before I see full moon, I guess, right? But if I were to venture a guess, I mentioned the final track, Super Moon, earlier. It's definitely one of the better tracks on the album, and it's got this sort of interesting sound that it's like... it's a very full sound, almost like... static. It doesn't really move that much, but there's a lot of reverb to it, and if that's where they end up going next, I definitely follow them. There's some cool stuff going on. It's almost like 8 minutes long, which is really not typical amongst the rest of the tracks in the album. They're all fairly short, and that's sort of where, if they're, you know, if any of these tracks are an indication of where they're going, that would be my guess. It's like boomier. It's more willing to sort of sit in that sound and sort of stay there and play with it than some of their earlier stuff. So it's pretty interesting. But DJ, that'll wrap up my opus for the week. DJ, what has Mr. Holland been composing for you lately?
Yeah, so one of the reasons we've not recorded an episode lately is that we've both been incredibly busy. The other reason is that this year's been off to a pretty rough start in terms of the new movies and new music being released. We're already 5 months into the year, right? And I've not really seen a whole lot at the cinema that's even marginally impressed me. And I've been even more disappointed, to be honest, by the menu of new music available this year. Like, I was so desperate for a new record that I could just simply enjoy that I came this close to actually purchasing the new Fall Out Boy album just because...
Hashtag save rock and roll.
Exactly, just because it features guest vocals from Elton John. But my opus this week brings us a slight glimmer of hope for 2013. It's the new record Pelagial from a group called The Ocean. These guys are a post-metal outfit hailing from Germany and featuring what is probably the least consistent lineup in modern metal. Their Wikipedia page states that 40 people have come and gone from the band since its inception in the year 2000. Now, in late April of this year, they've released Pelagial, which, given the name of their band, is probably their magnum opus as a group. Pelagial is a concept album with each track representing a different ecological zone within the open ocean, starting with the epipelagic layer near the ocean surface and progressing downward toward the benthic zone beneath the ocean floor. Now, obviously, this isn't an album about oceanography. The group has made it pretty clear that this is meant to be an exploration of the depths of the human psyche, whatever that actually means. They also use this concept of zones in the same sense as Andrei Tarkovsky's film Stalker, wherein a group of characters travel through a mysterious realm called The Zone to find a room that will grant their deepest wishes. That's all well and good, but does the album actually sound cool? And thankfully, yes, it does. This is probably the best record to come out yet this year, primarily because the songs are so perfectly crafted to fit the album's overall musical themes. For instance, the de facto opening track, Mesopelagic Into the Uncanny, drives forward with this up-tempo, kind of traditional metal beat representing all the life near the surface of the ocean. As the album proceeds downward, so to speak, the riffs become more massive and the tempos become more deliberate. Tracks 3 through 5 are a triptych called Bathypelagic, with the first movement featuring some great syncopated drum patterns. The second includes a lot of lead guitar work, and the third movement showcases rhythm guitar and bass. Then the abyssopelagic movements in tracks 6 and 7 illustrate kind of in Voltron style what the band can accomplish when all these elements work together and combine to form an unstoppable megazord. but by the time the hatopelagic movements kick in, the listener starts to see where this journey is headed. And indeed, by the time we reach the final track, Benthic, The Origin of Wishes, the Ocean are playing full-on doom metal. Now, this structure makes for a truly engaging start-to-finish listening experience, but your overall enjoyment of that experience is going to be largely dependent on your personal preference for the different flavors of metal. As for me, I like fast riffs with a lot of hooks, so in my book, it doesn't really get any better than the 4.5-minute mark on Mesopelagic, when the vocals are soaring over a hugely climactic guitar riff. Which, side note, the vocals throughout this album may actually be perfect. Loic Rossetti's range includes everything from pitch-perfect clean tones to like a hard rock rasp to a full-on death growl. But if your tastes in metal are similar to mine, then this album's going to end up feeling pretty darn front-loaded. With the possible exception of that Ancestors album you reviewed last year, Trav, I've never been a huge fan of doom metal, so to listen through this record knowing that each track is going to be increasingly doomish can be really kind of frustrating. But again, that's mostly a matter of personal preference, and if you happen to like doom metal, you might have the opposite experience to me. Oh, and just to get on my soapbox for a second, so The Ocean, like most metal bands, are very vocal in their ideology about being like anti-religion, anti-Christianity, anti-God, and everything like that. But if they're going to take that position, then I feel like they can't be quoting scripture inside their songs, because it's like they're like Sam Jackson's character in Pulp Fiction before he realizes what he's saying. So yeah, just that's just something that bothers me a little bit. But yeah, so I enjoyed the music on the record. Solid album, kind of one of the best I've heard this year. Trev, I know you're particularly excited. You were particularly excited for this album. Did it live up to your expectations?
Well, yeah, Stalker, which is the Andrei Tarkovsky's movie that a lot of the lyrics are based off of, is like my favorite movie. So when I saw in the a review from MetalSucks.net that it said with lyrics inspired by Stalker, I was like, well, I guess I'm buying this one. Yeah, I am definitely impressed with what The Ocean has put together. So one of the things you didn't get to, Deej, is that the album is, I guess I would say two discs, even though it's a digital album, but, or at least I downloaded it that way. I bought it that way. And the second disc is just an instrumental version of the album you just heard. And I really like that sort of really sort of ballsy move. Like, yeah, our riffs are so good that they can stand alone without vocals. And honestly, they do. I was on I was driving a lot for about 2 hours the other day, and I planned on just listening through the version of the album with vocals once through, and then switching to something else. But I was like, you know, I haven't really heard enough of this, and like you said, DJ, a lot of the best tracks are at the beginning, so I was like, yeah, I could listen to the instrumental version. And when that ended, I went back to the beginning with vocals, because I really am in love with this album. I probably enjoyed doom metal a lot more than you do, DJ. I like that sort of just like milking the ambiance that sound's able to do. So I actually I agree that a lot of the best songs are at the beginning, but I almost look forward to where it goes. So maybe for me, that makes it a little more of an enjoyable experience. I also really like the track Bathypelagic 3 Disequilibrated. Nope. yeah, that Disequilibrated.
I think it's disequilibrated.
There you go. That one. That one's really good. No, it's got a lot of really funky guitar work that's super cool. And I like you said, that that second track, Mesoplagic Into the Uncanny, has some really good hooks. And the hook that leads sort of the last third of the song comes out of nowhere and is super, super powerful and really cool. I guess, that's not, short of my just starting to sing it, I'm not really going to be able to explain it anymore, but where that song starts and goes is really cool. And just like when you're listening to it and you think, you know, this album is ordered to get more and more like heavy, and this is the first one. it's sort of cool to think like, man, I'm in for a treat. I don't know. I like how the album's structured. I like the fact that it's based on my favorite movie. So yeah, I am in love with this thing too. So I would think we both give this a definite recommendation, right, Deej?
Yeah, and if you just listen to the instrumental version, you don't have to suffer through their stupid, pseudo-intellectual, atheistic lyrics.
That's a good point. Well, after the break, we're going to go into our full-length review of Iron Man 3, so we'll see you there. And we're back to the Real House with Deej and Trav. We're about to jump into our full-length review of Iron Man 3. DJ, the first Iron Man movie is beloved by a lot of moviegoers, especially those who are fans of the sort of comic book movie genre. But the second Iron Man disappointed a lot of people, largely because it didn't really focus on Iron Man as much as people wanted it to. So, DJ, is Iron Man 3 a sort of return to form for Iron Man, you know, with a new director, Shane Black? Is it able to find some new life, or is the franchise still sort of going in the wrong direction in your eyes?
It's going further in the wrong direction. It actually makes me feel kind of bad having to discuss how terrible this movie is, especially because so many of my friends and acquaintances seem to have loved it. I don't want to take anything away from their enjoyment because I wish I could have had the same experience they did, but alas, I did not. I think one of the director's primary responsibilities in a big budget studio action film is to maintain control of the story. Take Gore Verbinski's first three Pirates of the Caribbean movies, for example. Those films are a perfect example and illustration of a guy slowly losing his grip on the plot over the course of three films. In the case of Iron Man 3, Shane Black takes the helm, recently vacated by Jon Favreau, the director of the first two Iron Men, and Black's hands begin to slip off the wheel before we're even out of the first act. Story beats occur seemingly at random, simply because the script says, this is what's supposed to happen next. So maybe Black isn't as much to blame as the writers themselves, but I still feel like it's his job to get the material onto the screen in a way that feels connected and internally consistent. At some point, someone should have been like, wait, this is an Iron Man movie we're making, but the majority of these scenes are taking place in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Something isn't right. The sure sign of failure is that this movie made me wish I was watching Iron Man 2.
At least to see Sam Rockwell dancing it up on stage, right?
Exactly. I mean, the performances here are fine, but everyone's clearly just collecting a paycheck because nobody tries to do anything remotely interesting with their characters in the way that Sam Rockwell delivered the kind of neurotic inferiority complex of that Justin Hammer character in Iron Man 2. Guy Pearce's character seems like he might be interesting in the first 5 minutes of the movie, but then he's basically repurposed as generic corporate villain, and you're left grasping for something that isn't totally by the book. Sure, you've got some cool action scenes in here, but you can find some pretty cool action clips on YouTube as well. We go to see movies because those action scenes have additional weight if we care about how they affect the growth of these characters. Unfortunately, Tony Stark's character arc in Iron Man 3 involves his wrestling with events that occurred in an entirely different and, again, superior film, so it's tough for that to be the audience's primary doorway into the story. What else? The score is laughably bad, but that's pretty much par for the course in all these Marvel Studios productions. Music composition is not their strong suit. Some people are praising Black's kind of somewhat postmodern take on the film, wherein Tony's like narrating the whole story retroactively, but I guess that only works if you like hearing a bunch of blather about how we all create our own demons. Yeah, I did not like this movie. I was hoping that with a new director coming on board, we'd see some fresh ideas, but if this is any indication of what Marvel's Phase 2 is going to look like post-Avengers, it's going to be a long haul until Avengers 2. Trav, what were your thoughts on Iron Man 3?
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't have to be the only one on the show who didn't like this movie. I didn't like it at all either. I'll just sort of go through my complaints, some of the ones you didn't cover. First, there's a bunch of plot holes in this movie. I won't go into specifics before we get into spoilers, but there's a lot of, and I guess not plot holes, but just plots that are dropped and subplots that are set up but never really concluded except for some throwaway lines here and there. We'll get into the specifics and spoilers. I think the script is like really boring. It's not that funny, and that's what a lot of the praise about the original Iron Man, why I like the original Iron Man so much, is that not only is it a good action movie, but the comedic elements really work as well. And I think Robert Downey Jr. does a good job at making those work, because he's just worked out, he's sort of figured out what his charisma is and what that consists in, so he can just sort of do that whether or not he's trying, and it works here. But I don't think that beyond him there's much here that's entertaining in terms of like wit or jokes or things. And the movie definitely tries to go for that sort of thing. The action is poorly executed and very poorly edited at some points, especially the hand-to-hand combat scenes. There's a sequence in Tennessee, as you mentioned, where there's a hand-to-hand fight with, like, it's the one that ends with a microwave. I'll just say that so it's not spoilery, but there's a point where there's almost no idea of what's going on, that there's no way to tell like whose fist is hitting whose face, and I really hate that in action movies. Like, you're an action movie, this is what you should be doing well. Like, I understand that's a hard thing to do, to show all this information at once, but if you're going to make a movie that's supposed to be the focus of the movie, that should be the thing you knock out of the park, and it should be some of the other things that I sort of give you a pass on. I shouldn't be giving an action movie a pass on poor action. My biggest gripe is that, and I'll explain in spoilers why this is so detrimental to the movie, the movie changes which minor character we're supposed to care about like every 20 minutes. First, Jon Favreau's character is of like laughable importance. Like, for some reason, this like security guy is like, should be like, if you were to take the 20 those first 20 minutes, like, he would be second billed in the movie. Like, he's
come on, it's Happy Hogan, he's got a rich backstory.
Like, he's that important here, which is baffling. And then he just stops being important through the rest of the movie. Then we follow this botanist character, and then we're following Colonel Rhodes, and then we're following this kid that he meets in Tennessee, and maybe I got the order wrong, and then we're following Pepper Potts for a while. And the movie leans pretty hard on the arcs of these minor characters. I'll go into specifics later, but like the way the movie ends requires those arcs to have been completely, especially one of them, to be completely tied up with like a neat bow, but like they gave up tying those halfway through each one of them, so the conclusion of the movie completely falls flat when these characters never get the time that the ending sort of assumes that they would have. There's some really weird stylistic inconsistencies, and unless I missed it earlier and later, I think there's only like 40 minutes of the movie where wipe dissolves are a thing, or like wipe transitions are a thing, but they're definitely there at least twice for a little bit, and I don't understand why you would do that. Like the sort of Star Wars wipe transition where it's like a slow wipe and for no reason, and it just baffles me that you would do that only a couple of times right next to each other.
Let's put one right here.
I'm confused by that. I guess that's a weird place to end before we get into spoilers, but that's where my spoiler-free notes end. DJ, do you have anything to say before we jump into spoilers?
No, I don't think I have anything else to add. You do not need to see this movie.
Agreed. So, Deej, start us up on the spoilers.
Yeah, so I totally agree with what you said about, like, it's not really a plot hole. It's just, like, where the plot vanishes suddenly, right? It's, like, where the sidewalk ends in terms of an absence of plot. So there are all these specific scenes that kind of come out of nowhere and then aren't really wrapped up in any kind of satisfactory fashion. So the one that I wrote down here in my notes is like, so there's this scene that takes place at the Chinese theater, and it's Los Angeles, right? And so I don't know why Happy Hogan is there or why the story is going there.
But I think it's supposed to be that he's following the shifty guy that he saw at Pepper's office. I think that's why he's there.
Okay, so he follows the guy there, and then it sets up this whole thing where there are people who are presumably like drug addicts to the to this extremist system that's been invented by Guy Pearce's character. Like, there's a guy who's kind of like a junkie sitting at the Chinese theater who needs like a fix of the extremist system so that, you know, he won't go through withdrawals or whatever. So the shifty guy, I think he's played by James Badge Dale, he gives the drugged out addict like a suitcase full of little doses of extremists, I guess, and then John Favreau like kind of intercepts it and grabs one of the vials to take back as a sample. That is like completely abandoned, unless I'm mistaken. Like the whole idea of people being like addicted to the extremist system never comes up again,
right?
Am I wrong in that? Or
yeah, no, we see people that like we see like in sort of like a flashback, it might even be like someone's watching a video of it occur, like when you see the original, the people who are testing it. But other than that, this idea that it's like a drug that you would take is sort of dropped. Yeah, there don't seem to be like addictive properties, especially when it's clear that this isn't even a pleasant experience for a lot of these people.
And it's so absurd because so Tony tries to retrace Happy's steps after the explosion occurs at the Chinese theater, and apparently Tony has developed like this kind of forensic analysis software that puts the pre-crime division in Minority Report to shame. Like, he can perfectly digitize every single detail in the scene. And so instead of finding the little capsule that Happy basically sacrificed his life to get, which would have pointed Tony straight back to Guy Pearce's character, instead he finds dog tags which take him on a wild goose chase through Chattanooga, Tennessee, trying to find out who these like suicide bombers are. So it's like he has this elaborate software, but he can't even find the right object that he's supposed to be looking for.
Yeah, it's confusing. One of the so there are two things in the movie that I just have. There are two questions I have for you, DJ, unless I'm missing something else. And I've asked a couple people this, and I haven't really gotten a, I got some of an explanation for one, but I still don't buy it. So the first question is, so if Aldrich Killian, Guy Pearce's character, if his goal is, you know, he sets up this straw man of the Mandarin. Oh, we didn't even really mention Ben Kingsley as the Mandarin.
No big surprise.
I mean, I think he's like, he's good when he's on those, like, when he's doing those recordings and, like, playing the character of the Mandarin, when the character's playing the character. I think he does a good job then, but it's just sort of goofy. But anyway, if Aldrich Killian just wants to get the vice president in the presidency, if that's, like, his end game, so that he has, like, a patron in, you know, the strongest, you know, the most powerful position in the United States, why does he bother with all of the smaller attacks of, like, you know, getting these people to inject too much and causing these explosions and setting up this straw man of the Mandarin if he can just one time have someone be near the president and inject themselves too much? Then he won't have to go through all the trouble, right?
I had basically the same thing written down in my notes as I was going to ask you the same question. And I've kind of seen floating around the internet, this is kind of the pervasive question about Iron Man 3, is no one really understands what Guy Pearce was trying to do. So I think I caught briefly that the reason he created this character, the Mandarin, in the first place is because he wasn't planning on having his extremist subjects blow up. And so when they did, he needed to cover that up somehow, and so he created the Mandarin to, like, claim responsibility for those explosions as acts of terror. But then, yeah, it stops making sense because, so Guy Pearce is attempting to position the vice president, played by Twin Peaks alum Miguel Ferrer, as the new president, but then Ferrer is in turn assisting Guy Pearce so that his disabled daughter, the vice president's disabled daughter, can take advantage of the extremist system. So it's kind of like a snake eating its tail scenario. It's like, who is actually doing what here and to what end? And it's like,
And like, by the end, like, the based on the things that Guy Pearce starts saying, and like, it doesn't look like he really cares about extremists being successful. So like, why does he bother, like, trying to make that, like, other than, like, making himself, like, be able to breathe fire? Like, he's obviously pretty into that, but, like, in terms of, like, giving it to other people, he doesn't really seem to care about the, like, success of this product that he's creating. So even in the case of, like, creating the Mandarin to cover up these acts, this sort of, like, breakage that naturally occurs with his product, like, that doesn't really matter. It doesn't make sense why he would even care about that, because his whole goal is to, I guess, to have the vice president. I don't know. I guess it doesn't make sense to either of us. And my second question is, so the way Tony gets out of the whole thing is that in the end he calls in all the different Iron Man suits to go, like, in automated mode and, like, oh man, look at all these cool different Iron Mans.
Look at all these action figures you can buy.
Exactly. But, like, so originally I had the question, why doesn't he do that, like, a long time before that? And the answer I got from people was like, oh, because there's rubble from the house. And I was like, okay, I guess that makes sense. The rubble was covering the hole that the Iron Man would have come out of. But
so apparently Rubble Man beats Iron Man.
yeah, but then I was like, well, no, because we've seen that an unarmed version of Iron Man can still beat up tanks, like, or not tanks, helicopters. So am I supposed to believe that a legion of Iron Men cannot take on rubble? Like, I don't buy that. So that's annoying. Some of the other little plot holes or plot drops. So what happened to the whole subplot about, like, Pepper perhaps falling for Guy Pearce? Like, that's like, why Jon Favreau's character is really important at the beginning, because he's like, oh, hey, you know, Pepper seems to be developing, might be interested in this guy, and you should be jealous, Tony. But then, like, other than this stupid line at the end, Guy Pearce says, like, oh, I would have caught her. Like, other than that, there's, like, no, not even a nod to that possibility. Oh, and this one's interesting. Friend of the show, Jordan Peterson, mentioned this to me. So why would he choose an unarmed suit to be the one to protect the house instead of the dozens that he has downstairs? Let's see what else. Okay, so yeah, my big complaint about this movie is that in the end, it's Pepper Potts that gets like the final blow on Aldrich Killian, and like it's supposed to be this huge, this big deal that, you know, they're like their relationship, that Tony and Pepper are gonna be like, you know, they're starting over for each other or whatever. But like prior to the last bit of the movie, she'd had like two lines. Like almost no time is dedicated to her except for some small like jokes about a weird rabbit. But like I can't grant the movie its conclusion without, I mean, I can't accept that the movie ends that way when not enough time was allocated to that character. Do you think that's unfair, Deej, or do you agree?
No, I agree. It's like the primary resolution of the movie comes via a character that has vanished for like a solid hour of the movie.
Yeah. Anything else?
No,
Do we have any more dead horses to beat?
Yeah, I definitely agree with your comment about like the armor showing up at the end. Like that's my cardinal sin in terms of like movie criticism, right? Is when you defy your movie's own internal logic just to have a scene that looks cool. Like it makes me so angry. It's like, did you even pay any attention to the previous hour that came before this? I don't know. It frustrating, frustrating.
All right. Well, that'll end things for Iron Man 3. Before we close up the show, Deej, where can fans of the show find you around the interwebs?
You can follow me on Twitter at DJ Wheeler, and you can follow me on This Is My Jam at DJ Wheeler.
You can find me on Twitter and This Is My Jam. Usually there's another one, I forget. But Twitter and This Is My Jam under the handle TheTravisW. You can follow the show on Twitter at The Real House, The R-E-E-L House. Please rate and review the show on iTunes. Writing a review makes us more visible in iTunes, like when you search for us and things. Tell your friends about the show if your friends are movie or music inclined, or not. Just like force them to listen to it. Gosh, there's other things. If you have any questions or suggestions about the show or what you think we should be reviewing, you can email me at thethirdreel@gmail.com. That's thethirdreel@gmail.com. And as always, didn't you say something about a beautiful speedboat?